doing the mad camera scramble for everything today. Does that look better? All right, we got it. So we have a very special sermon as we move from that wonderful anthem today. Many of you know and have been experiencing from some of our other liturgy contributions. Our intern Robin Klossman-Wright has been joining us, doing a great job of joining us in ministry, both here on Sundays and also in different things during the week. It's been a great pleasure to work with Robin so far, and so I'm excited that today we get to do a sermon together. As we were looking at the passages coming up in Luke and thinking about ways that she can continue to work on her different aspects of ministry, including giving sermons, I guess this one jumped out, and I think she's got a really interesting, compelling, relatable way for us to get into these lessons that Jesus is giving through this imagery. It was occurring to me this morning, it's maybe a little bit cheesier, and I don't know if you were thinking about this, but the idea of connecting to a bird with wings over chicks goes very well for Robin, I think, very much. So very appropriate, and Robin's going to start us off with the sermon. We'll do a little bit of a team thing, but I'm sure that you'll enjoy it as much as I am expecting to.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning. So I wanted to talk to you first this morning about some childhood memories that I have. When I was a little girl, I have a younger sister, and the two of us would play with our dolls endlessly. There wasn't always much money growing up in my family, but Santa somehow always managed to bring us the most beautiful baby dolls, and we would play with these dolls for forever. We would change them and feed them and dress them and carry them around the house with us everywhere we went. And one of the favorite role plays that we would engage in with these babies and other stuffed animals and things was to get on the couch and pretend that it was this big boat and that it was a big sea. The living room floor was a big sea, and there's, you know, big storms that would come up, and, you know, somebody always had to fall off the boat and be rescued, and we would pull them on the boat, you know, and yay, everybody was safe. So these are really important and meaningful and just fun stories memories that I have of my sister and I playing with these dolls. A really important part of that part was to feel that everybody was protected at the end, you know. So the story of Ruth protecting her family is something that speaks to me very deeply. And so it's very meaningful when in chapter 2, verse 12, Boaz blesses Ruth because he recognizes that Ruth is one who is living on the margins, but she's acting and boldly out of her faith. And she's doing this to care for Naomi instead of acting out of fear. So Boaz is aware of her vulnerability and acts as her protector, using his own position of safety under the God's sheltering wing to secure and protect Ruth and, by extension, Naomi, of course. Jesus longs to offer that same protection to the children of Israel, and yet they refuse it. They choose instead to act out of fear. Both of these stories speak to that part of me that always loved taking care of other people. In fact, the book of Ruth uses the word hesed to describe this form of love. Hesed is a word that implies action. So one would not say something like, I hesed you. Instead, it means the compassionate loyalty that we have or that we act out of when we love someone. It means devotion. It means loving kindness. So when we act in those ways, that is the Hebrew word for that is hesed. When my turn came to be a real mom, I loved pretty much every minute of being a mother. I just loved being a mom. I loved every moment of taking care of them and chauffeuring them and sitting at games with them and doing all the things that moms do, except cooking. I didn't ever like cooking. So, my husband once said, while our kids were little, that he could not wait for his kids to get bigger so that he could have conversations with them and that he could do things with them that were fun and interesting. And I was crushed that he said that. And later on that evening, I said to him, "You're wishing our kids' lives away." I said, you're wishing our time with them away. And he was really surprised that I had interpreted it that way. And he comforted me and he assured me that he was not. Now that our kids are older, I get it. I understand what he was talking about. And they're a lot of fun to be with. I understand why he might have felt that way. But that transition was not an easy transition for me, and maybe not for them either. At least at times it wasn't. I'm certain there were times I was overprotective or fell short in some way. And at the same time, I was also aware of the importance of them learning to be self-sufficient. It was a constant struggle to find the balance in those moments. And I'm just thankful that I had a husband who worked with us as a team so that we could get through all of those times together. But we actually have a story that we kind of, today we enjoy telling the story. And it talks about, I think it illustrates the point of transition or the issue of transition. So my son had just graduated from Ohio University. He was a major in, he got a bachelor's in music education, and he wanted to teach. But as a teacher, he felt it was important to get his master's, and he was determined. And in fact, at the moment, he thought he might teach college as well. So he was determined to study for his doctorates under a professor in California, and he thought his best chance of getting into that program was to study under one of that professor's former students for his master's. So none of these professors that had studied under him taught anywhere close to Central Ohio, and he chose to go to Southern Oregon University, which is in Ashland, Oregon, about 15 miles over the California border. The summer after graduation, he spent at home, and it sped by. Labor Day weekend came quickly, and he made arrangements to sublet a house from a faculty member at SOU who was going to be teaching overseas, and he and some other friends would take the house, care for it while she was away for her year, and they would stay there. So the arrangement was a little bit flimsy. My husband and I weren't really comfortable with the arrangement that he had made, but he assured me that it was, you know, fine. I didn't know a lot back then. And the arrangement was set, and they were packed and ready to go. So the plan was that I was to go on this trip across country with him. He didn't need to take many things with him, just his clothes and instruments, not much else. And we were going to drive out, see a few things, and then I was going to fly back. But at the last moment, he decided he wanted to invite a friend, and I felt, even though he assured me I was still welcome to come, I felt that he would have a lot more fun if he and the friend went. So I backed out and stayed. I was a little bit disappointed, but I chose to focus on the fact that I didn't have to fly home alone, and so that was a good thing. So it was difficult getting the two of them out the door that morning. We decided at the last minute to go out for breakfast. We had to pack the car. He left, forgot things, had to come back. So it was quite a difficult endeavor getting him just out the door. And we finally got him on the road mid-afternoon. They were stopping in Denver for a few days with a friend who now lived there. And the first leg of this trip went fine. He was happy. Things went well. The day that they left Denver, they barely got out of the Denver area that they were in, and he got a call from the professor that he was to be subletting from. She had decided to not teach overseas after all, and because the lease was loosely written, he didn't have a place to stay. But the roommates were on it. They were going to get it all taken care of before he got there. It didn't matter that he had no bed, no furniture, no dishes, but they were going to figure something out and take care of it. So at the next stop, not too far down the road, he dropped his phone and shattered the screen. Now, traveling across country without a phone was bad, and that would have been bad enough, but he had also refused our offer of a GPS. He was convinced that the phone would be adequate and that he didn't need to be messing around with another instrument. So he not only had no phone, but he had no GPS. But still, we're good because his friend was with him. They could use his phone. So so he just kept on trudging down the road. And they pulled into Salt Lake City that night where they were going to stay. And the general attitude that night when he went to sleep was, really, Mom, you overreact. What more could happen? So the next morning, they got up and left, and they traveled into Nevada. They weren't more than a couple hours into Nevada. The temperatures were rising in the desert, and he blew his engine. So we weren't positive at that moment that the engine was blown, so it was necessary to go back to this small town they had passed, rent a U-Haul truck, which was the cheapest way to do it, tow the car on into Ashland where somebody could look at it and see what was happening, and hopefully get it fixed. So he did this, and he moved forward again, anxious to put this trip at this point into the history books. So the goal was to reach Ashland that night. And in western Nevada, they were to stop going west and go north and go as far north in Nevada as they could, then turn and go west again into California. And at that point, with Ashland being only 15 miles over the border, you know, it should be an easy 2 or 3 hours left in the trip. So he did it. He turned north, and somewhere he missed the turn to go west. Now, I don't know if any of you are familiar with this part of the country, but he traveled into north into southeastern Oregon. So this is not a densely populated area. And he didn't realize what he had done at first, and he continued on an hour or maybe two, thinking this was much further than it had looked on the map, but he kept on going. Eventually, he realized he must have missed the turn, but the environment had changed rapidly, and they were moving into canyons and now traveling on roads that were too narrow to allow a large truck towing a car to turn around. They were traveling on barely more than dirt roads and climbing higher. The sun was disappearing and temperatures were dropping. They had no clue where they were, and none of us realized there was a problem because they had lost cell phone service. He wasn't due into Ashland until around 1 o'clock our time, and my husband is a night owl, so he was waiting up until they had arrived. Going to bed without knowing he had arrived safely wasn't something I would normally do, but that night I felt comfortable that my husband was on duty and that God had them in their protective care and that Drew was capable, and so I went ahead and went to bed around 11. Sometime around 12, my husband's cell phone rang. He answered, expecting to hear that they had arrived, but instead, Drew was frantic, and it was easy to hear in his voice. He was trying to remain calm so as not to upset his friend, or maybe he was trying not to upset us, or maybe both, and his friend was doing the same, but it was clear they were scared. The situation had gotten dangerous. They fortunately found cell service. They were high enough that they could get some cell phone service and call us. But the roads had become very steep along cliffs that were sheer drop-offs. And they were too narrow to pass. And at times, his friend and he could feel that the earth was kind of giving way underneath the car. They were both quite scared. They were not sure the truck was going to be able to continue to tow up the steep hills any longer, and they had no idea what they were going to do at that point. So adding to this fear was that they were running out of gas. The sun had gone down. It was pitch black. They had not seen any cars for hours. The most they had seen were a few snakes and a coyote. So the sun went down, and they became cold and hungry and very lost. What happened next, in my opinion, is an intervention from God, because they came up on a gas station in the middle of nowhere. Now, of course, at this hour, it was closed, but there was a house nearby, and it had a light on. I did not want him to go to the house. I only could imagine that, you know, someone looking much like Grizzly Adams was behind that door, and not as friendly. So he went anyway, and only my son could find what laid behind this door, and it was a film crew filming a documentary about two families in the area who were having a land dispute. When they answered the door, they were shocked to see Drew and his friend, and they couldn't understand how he possibly could have gotten there, and it wasn't likely he was getting out without a GPS. They were in what was considered to be, or what is considered to be, the most remote area of the United States in the lower 48 states. So the crew gave them some directions to the closest 24-hour gas station, which was at least an hour, maybe two, away, and they wished them luck. And so we spent the rest of that night on the phone guiding them on our GPS and on our phone and our maps to this gas station and reassuring them and keeping them calm as they traveled. They found the gas station, and we called ahead another to the next town, which was still another hour away, to get them a hotel room where they spent the night. And the next morning, they limped into Ashland, battered and bruised, at least emotionally and spiritually, about the whole ordeal. We talked and decided we would give him my car, but we had to get the car to him. And so after investigating a few options, I insisted on being the one to go. I could not get to Oregon fast enough. I drove alone between 12 and 16 hours for 3 days straight, every day. And the relief in his voice was obvious when we told him I was on my way. But it was nothing compared to the hug I received as I got out of the car in Ashland. His gratitude for a wing to take refuge under was obvious. In contrast, though, exactly 3 years later, on Labor Day weekend, again, he moved, this time from Denver to Greensboro, North Carolina. Now, he had relocated to Denver after graduating SOU, and after being away for 3 years, he wanted to return closer to home. Well, he had a better plan this time, but he wanted no part of the protective wing. He declined our offers to help with the move for a place to stay on the last night of the trip, and also for our assistance once he was in Greensboro to unload. He wanted to do this on his own, and he chose to not embrace the protective wing this time, much like the people of Jerusalem, who felt they did not need the protective wing of God around them either.
That's definitely one of those stories that grips you a lot, Robin, and thanks so much for sharing that and starting to make those connections to the imagery that we have of a bird holding her wings over her chicks. I think probably a lot of us can relate to those feelings. Maybe it's not always our kids that have had those times of sort of making us feel like we really got to reach to make sure that they're still cared for. But other folks in our lives going through difficult circumstances. I am quite sure that my parents are having all of the times in their minds that they thought, oh, Rob, what the heck are you doing? And we got to help you figure something out right now. Because we all have those times as we're growing up, maturing, wanting to figure things out for ourselves, but also valuing the relationships that we have, even if there's a little tension back and forth. It was especially powerful for me to hear you talk about the range of ways that you and your son seem to feel about that imagery of putting care over each other that way. Depending on what the circumstances were, depending on what your relationship to each other felt like in the moment, and definitely even keeping in mind the way that God was watching over everything as well. Because that's one of the things that was most striking to me about when we read these passages, especially together between Ruth and the Gospel of Luke, is that there's this range of ways that these passages can have meaning in our own lives because of all of those relationships and circumstances that we find ourselves in. And so the imagery can capture even that full breadth. You've helped us see in particular how the gathering of God over his people is an encouragement to Ruth and Boaz, especially as they are thinking about their own positions and hopes for being a comfort, that they see God as a comfort and an example, and that brings them courage as they try to offer their own provision and support to other people. And I think then we can see that traditional encouraging imagery of the hen and chicks as being something that relates to our lives, but we know that there can be a lot more to it as well. Like you said, the Luke passage really expands on the ways that we learn about how God can care for us with this metaphor. We see Jesus longing maybe for that traditional sense of how a hen cares for chicks, and yet we know it's not that easy. A lot of times it's a lot more complicated. There's a lot more tension, and it definitely seemed to be that Jesus was feeling that strongly at the time that he was saying this. We've been talking throughout the Luke series about how Jesus knew that his ministry was going to involve challenging a lot of things in people's lives. We've seen how Jesus was challenging people's traditional expectations about who was important, about how God worked and brought success into different people's lives, about who was valuable. And that Jesus was also challenging a lot of existing power structures and how they might have a different idea than God did of who was important, about how we bring success and wholeness and who gets to benefit from that. And that Jesus knew that as he established this new saving way of living in his ministry that saves us from sin, that transforms the way that we can have relationships together, that he was going to meet resistance or confusion. Maybe some people would be curious but not know exactly what it would mean to follow Jesus fully, so he would continue to teach them. And others may even say that they didn't want any part of that, and they would see Jesus as a threat to the things that they got power and benefit from, and so they would want to get rid of him. He knew that when he didn't match up with people's expectations, he would have to keep gathering people and helping them grow in their understanding. He knew that when people saw him as a threat and resisted the changes that he was trying to bring and encourage others to live into as well, that he would come under attack. He would have to be defensive. He would have to sometimes retreat for a little bit to a new place to minister. But now he was knowing he was going to have to face things down and that it would not be easy, that it would bring cost to himself. But he wanted to remain faithful. He wanted to help his followers continue to know what it was that they were joining up for, but also that they would have the strength and support that they needed to be his followers and to continue his ministry. I think we see especially the reality of the external threats, and we can all think of the times where we have seen things around us that feel like they are bearing down on us, like we don't know whether or not we'll make it through, even with God's help. Jesus saw Herod in particular as that fox, that external threat, and knew that there was a Roman Empire that was backing him at the expense of regular people that gave him real teeth and real claws. And so he knows then that as that's looming over things, that there's still this tension of the relationship between a hen and a chicks. Sometimes, like Ruth and Boaz, we want to run to the hen when we see the threats. Other times, we wonder a little bit whether that will be enough, and the chicks scatter. We go off looking for something else that we think will help us more. And so we get into some more positions and relationships for these metaphors that I think we can relate to even beyond the desire to care, like your story really lifted up. And we can start to wonder, even if Jesus, if God is offering us comfort, what is it that still, as one of my favorite hymns, Be Thou My Vision, calls out, what makes us so prone to wander? Makes us wonder, how do we cope when we not only think about trying to have a type of connection with God that we want, but also whether the threats around us that stress us and worry us so much can our faith really be enough to carry us through? What really struck me then as I thought about all of these relationships, all of these dynamics to the metaphor that really make it vital to us in all circumstances, is that Jesus sticks with the image of a mother hen in particular. Even if we think about imagery of mothers, but parents in general, that Jesus could have chosen, and that we think about in our own culture, we don't hear a lot of mother hen type of imagery anymore. We hear a lot about things like mama bears, hear about things about tiger moms or helicopter moms, but not like a mother hen. And, you know, there's this serving vulnerable love to the imagery of a hen that we don't quite get with those other images that have become more popular, and that maybe could have even been something that crossed Jesus' mind, but he gravitated to that hen imagery specifically. Because can't we worry whether or not there's actually enough strength in the hen type of love compared to the violence that comes from don't mess with the mama bear, you'll get the claws, or the close supervision and control of a helicopter hovering over everything? Feels like that might get things under control a lot better. And I wonder if that's why we're often tempted to scatter as chicks. Because we grow into our own roles of responsibility, and it sure can seem sometimes like the fox will come out a lot better on the end of conflicts with the hen more often when we see that. And so while we see how Ruth and Boaz were encouraged by God's comfort and the wings that God offered them, we can probably also relate to the idea that it can be hard to trust sometimes. And so instead, the traditional ruling, the taking advantage bravado of the fox becomes appealing and tempting in comparison to the quiet, faithful, serving, vulnerable courage of the hen. So we can relate to chicks that seek comfort, but we can also relate to chicks that seek other types of advantage and power around us. And maybe even sometimes we relate to the fox and wanting to get as much power and advantage as we can. We also relate to the loving service of the hen, but also the hen struggling to support people that don't always want it, like you were mentioning as well. So what values do we use to respond to all of those different range of circumstances and feelings and relationships that we can have, hoping again that we see God sovereign over all of it? So I'm curious to hear, Robin, how you've continued to reflect on that story and your other experiences as a mother hen, as a chick, and figuring out how is it that God can teach me through passages like this, through God's presence in your life, how you can navigate your own set of circumstances and relationships, even when it's difficult.
Yeah, that is the interesting part of looking at these two verses and this story in light of those verses. So as Pastor Rob mentioned, he and I talked about the idea of tiger moms and mother bears. And honestly, before this week, I probably would have said, yeah, that was probably the kind of mom I am without giving it a whole lot of thought. But each of these terms does carry that connotation of control with them. And so I really relate to this idea of being protective and the devotion that a mother hen has, that chesed kind of moment, more accurately, I think, describes my view of my own role. But with that said, the roles can become easily confused, and feelings of rejection and independence, fear, or just simple changes like a child growing into an adult can flip the tables on us and cause us to maybe not respond the way we think, out of who we think we are. We can move quickly from being one who shares the blessing of love that shelters and protects to a love that dominates and controls. The love of the mother hen has the power to gather us together, restore us, and even empower us to be who we were created to be. Whereas the role of the fox is to operate out of fear and control. A fox is a dangerous predator, and it simply wants to divide the flock so it can single out its prey and attack. If you look closely at the story of Ruth, you will find that Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz never pray for themselves, only for one another. They develop this relationship throughout the story that is based on service, compassion, loyalty, and loving kindness. It's chesed at its most meaningful demonstration of love in action. They are able to do this because they never act out of fear. They may have fear, but they only act in faith, they trust in God, and they embrace their vulnerability. Whereas the children of Jerusalem refuse the offer of Jesus and his sheltering wing, and instead they embrace their fears and they side with the fox. But what we may miss if we do not listen closely and take time to consider is that while the hen is offering sheltering to the chicks she has gathered under her wings, she herself is left vulnerable. In the same way, Jesus has been warned. Herod is looking for him, and he probably is looking to kill him. Immediately, Jesus recognizes Herod as the fox, trying to get him in a position of fear. But Jesus consisted in trusting God, his plan, and Jesus' desire to offer Jerusalem the shelter, even though it makes him vulnerable to stick around and do so. Author Brené Brown bases most of her research in understanding the power of vulnerability. She shared this with Forbes magazine. "My ability to lean into discomfort of vulnerability limited the fullness of those important experiences that are wrought with uncertainty. Love, belonging, trust, joy, and creativity, to name a few. These are amazing and wonderful experiences that I believe God wants us to have. But we have to remain vulnerable to experience them fully. We can't allow ourselves to operate out of fear, because if we do, we will become the fox, not the hen." That first night and the week that followed was scary for all of us in Oregon. But we gathered together and worked to see them through it. I don't mind saying that there was a tremendous amount of prayer going on that night and for even the days that followed. And we were only too willing to allow God to gather us in. As a result, we experienced something that will forever define our relationship. During the second move, that did not happen, at least not between the three of us. As I was writing this and looking back on that second cross-country move, I realized that he may not have been so much rejecting me or Mother Hen, but he was wanting to have that experience of vulnerability with his now wife. And they were sharing in a moment of vulnerability that has probably defined their relationship. Jesus is longing to place the people of Jerusalem under his wing, and so that they may know the power of vulnerability and live more fully. So it may be that when we are experiencing fear, whether it's fear over a change we are experiencing ourselves, or the fear of the pandemic, or a fear of the most of just what lies ahead, the most meaningful question we can ask ourselves is, am I being the fox? Am I acting out of fear to control my life or to control the lives of others around me and avoid pain? Or am I ready to lean in to the discomfort of vulnerability like the hen?